We present the best of South African radio drama for your listening pleasure in Radio Theatre. And now, Act One of this week's story.
We present The Blessington Letters, a play for Settlers Day by Annette McKenzie and Jack Mullen. The Blessington Letters.
Cape Colony, Wednesday, the 6th of March, 1907. My dear mother, my very first letter from South Africa. It will perhaps seem strange to you to see the words Cape Colony at the head of this page. I assure you, it is even more strange to write them. For whilst the reality of my surroundings leaves me in no doubt that I have, in fact, arrived at my destination, a part of my brain seems unable to believe it. The voyage was both enjoyable and salutary, and I am now eager to apply myself to my new profession. Speaking of which, I hope and trust that I shall soon dispel any remaining misgivings you may have about the wisdom of my decision to come here. I know that while for my sake you have attempted to bury your doubts, the echoes remain.
Africa? You've decided to go to Africa?
South Africa, Mother.
Whether it be south, north, east, or west is of little consequence. Why Africa at all? It's a continent of war and savages.
The war in South Africa has been over for 5 years, Mother.
I'm aware of that, Geoffrey. What on earth would you do with yourself in South Africa? The family has no background of colonial service.
I intend to farm.
To farm? And is it really necessary to undertake a journey to distant Africa for that purpose? If the home farm doesn't satisfy you, there's no shortage of good farmland in England. There's Uncle Gerald's place in Warwickshire, and he has another somewhere in Ireland. Queen's County, I believe. Yes, Queen's County. I'll speak to Gerald and...
Thank you, Mother, but I already have a place of my own. In the Cape Colony.
I see. Naturally, you must do as you think fit, Geoffrey. But frankly, I'm somewhat taken aback. It has come as rather a surprise to me.
I know, Mother. I know. It's a sheep farm, actually, in the middle of a semi-desert.
Geoffrey, do you seriously intend to live in a desert surrounded by sheep? Like some Sudanese shepherd.
It won't be quite as primitive as you make it sound, Mother.
I'm merely repeating what you said, Geoffrey. And you must agree, it does sound primitive. Positively nomadic, in fact.
Well, I assure you it's not. It's a very dry climate and very healthy, I understand. Sheep do well there.
That's comforting, if you happen to be a sheep. But people, Geoffrey, how do people fare in this arid wasteland?
Really, Mother, I'm not dashing off into the Sahara, you know. There are lots of farms, many English families. It's quite a well-established community. I'm not exactly pioneering or breaking new ground.
Perhaps not. But you see it as adventurous and exciting, don't you? Oh, if you feel you must get away, why not take yourself up to Scotland for a few months?
Mother, I've already bought the farm. I own it.
You've purchased a farm? Are you serious, Geoffrey?
Absolutely serious. That's why I'm telling you now, Mother. Richard acted as my agent in the matter. I received a letter from him this very morning. The transaction has been finalized and the property is now registered in my name. I own it.
Your cousin Richard in Africa? What has come over this family all of a sudden? Some wanderlust or strange foreign fever that has everybody uprooting themselves and hurrying away to Africa? I find it most peculiar. I had no idea Richard had gone there.
He hasn't left England, Mother. He managed the negotiations from this end.
Am I therefore to understand that you have purchased a sheep farm on the African continent, sight unseen, Geoffrey?
Yes, Mother, I have.
How extraordinary. I must say I find it very difficult to believe. In other words, you have no conception of what lies in store for you.
But of course I have. I have a complete description of the farm, an inventory of its equipment, stock, everything.
But you've seen nothing. You have a piece of paper with a description, which I have no doubt is highly coloured and extremely euphemistic.
Richard is experienced in these matters. Too experienced to allow any double-dealing, if that's what you're suggesting.
What I'm suggesting is that you take advice from our solicitors. Perhaps there's some way in which you can extricate yourself from this ill-advised commitment.
Mother, I don't wish to extricate myself. I am entirely happy with the transaction. Oh, I appreciate your concern, and I know that your sole intention is to prevent me from indulging in what you obviously consider to be an act of gross folly. Believe me, it is not. Or should I say, I sincerely hope it is not.
Oh, Geoffrey, Geoffrey, so headstrong, so stubborn. And I suppose if I were to be truly honest with myself, I should admit that my reasons for opposing your intended departure are not wholly unselfish. Put quite simply, I shall miss you and worry about you.
There is a fascination about the Karoo which is difficult to express. Can you imagine limitless miles of red, parched earth, stretching to horizons undulating with heat? Can you imagine this seemingly infinite plain studded with sparse knots of strange, sun-scorched little bushes, peppered with low, barren hills, which incidentally are called by the Dutch word, koppies? The vastness of the landscape puts man and all his mundane affairs into true perspective. I've just read the above attempted description and find that, despite the poetic overtones of the language, it really captures nothing of the Karoo. Perhaps there is no way to explain it. It is more to be experienced than spoken of. That is something you could bear in mind, Mother, the prospect of a visit out here. I hope one day you will make the journey. I know that you would find the climate most agreeable, and I'm sure that you would enjoy seeing the farm, or at least a part of it, since in toto it is larger than the Channel Islands put together. I expect you may find that hard to believe. So did Barrett at first. Incidentally, you wouldn't recognize your erstwhile underfootman, Mother. I'm glad I persuaded him to accompany me. He was the right person to bring along. Even in so short a space of time, I can see that he has already taken to this new life like a duck to water. That simile is rather inappropriate, since water is something he has found little of in his new surroundings. Seven Oaks, Cape Colony. 7:25, Monday, April the 22nd, 1907. Dear Gladys, hope this finds you in the pink, as it leaves me. Well, not pink anymore, nor red neither, though I was red enough for the first few weeks here. It seems like we've got a different sun in this country, and much more of it. You'd scarce believe how hot it is. Stand out in it for 10 minutes, and you're like a beetroot. Leastways, that's how it was at first. But I'm getting used to it now. And instead of getting red, I go more of a mahogany shade. Same colour as her ladyship's dining room table. I'm sorry I've taken so long to write, after having promised you and all. Truth to tell, there's been so much on the go since we arrived, I just never got a chance until now. Did you notice I've written Seven Oaks at the top of this letter? That's Mr. Geoffrey's name for the farm, and he hopes to have seven good English oaks a-growing in due course. The life out here's so different. You just couldn't imagine it, Gladys. And nothing like we thought it would be. When I think of all the wrong guesses we made. Mr. Geoffrey's paying me fair out there, so why not take the opportunity and go? But that's the way I see it. How else would I ever get to Africa?
But, Tom, all those lions and tigers and all.
Oh, there ain't no tigers in Africa, Gladys. Didn't they teach you that at school?
Well, lions, then. There'll be lions there.
Yeah, I shouldn't wonder. Quite a few of those lions knocking around, I expect.
They prowl around the jungle. I read about it once in a book.
Hmm?
And there's swamps and snakes and people die of terrible fevers.
Not everyone. Lots of folk live to tell the tale. What about David Livingstone, then?
He's one of the people I was thinking about. He died of a terrible fever.
Because he ran out of quinine, that's why. Oh, went to Sunday school too, you know. And don't forget all the adventures he had. Don't forget that. That's just what I'm looking forward to. All the adventures. Just think of it, Gladys. Instead of me being stuck here, having supper in the servants' hall, we'll be building campfires, cooking our meals under the stars.
That's if Alain doesn't make a meal of you first, Tom Barrett. I reckon you're mad to think of going when you're doing so well here. Remember, Jenkins will be retiring one of these days, and that will mean promotion for everyone. You too. From under footman to footman.
Yeah, I know, Gladys. I know all about that. We'll all move one rung up the ladder. Oh, being in service is a nice, steady job, I grant you. Safe. Well, that's the whole trouble. I'm 19. I've been here since the day I left school. Life's just passing me by. I want to do something different, something out of the ordinary, before I settle down.
I should think it would be much harder to settle down once you got used to jungles and such like.
No, because then I'd have done it, you see. I'd have done it. And I'd have something to remember, to look back on. Anyway, even supposing I wanted to settle down, how could I? Well, you're only 16, as your dad keeps reminding me.
What's that got to do with you settling down, then?
Well, when you're old enough, and I've saved enough money, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a little place of our own?
If you survived the jungle and all them wild animals.
We had all the wrong ideas of what it would be like out here. Oh, sorry about the big blot. I tried to mop it up, and it made it worse. Gladys, guess what? I might have been the owner of this farm, believe it or not. What a lark. Me owning a farm. Ha ha. But it could have happened. Before Mr. Geoffrey bought it, the man who owned it put it up as a prize in a lottery. At £5 a ticket. That's the truth, Gladys, so help me. I don't really know what happened about the lottery. Maybe he didn't sell enough tickets or something. Then along comes Mr. Geoffrey and ups and buys it. But the fact remains, if yours truly had been here then, and always supposing I'd had enough money to buy a ticket, the farm could have been mine, if I'd won the lottery. Oh, well, it's nice to dream about it. And so are you. Write and tell me all the news. How's her ladyship doing, by the way? I dare say she's sorely missing Mr. Geoffrey.
Blessington Hall, Wednesday, 25th of December, 1907. My dearest Geoffrey, my thoughts are with you this Christmas day. Charles and Helen and the two children are, of course, here for the holiday period, but I'm very much aware that our family circle is incomplete. It has been snowing since Monday, and as I look out through the library window, everything is cloaked in soft, quiet whiteness. The icicles jutting down from the cornice above the window, like tapering glass fingers, remind me of when you and Charles were little boys and used to snap them off and employ them very briefly as fencing foils. How long ago that seems. How long ago and how recent. The children have built a snowman on the croquet lawn and are busily engaged in some esoteric rite which involves dancing around it in circles and throwing handfuls of snow into the air. Seeing them out there, wrapped up against the cold, I find it impossible to imagine that where you are, there is heat and sunshine.
Merry Christmas, Barrett.
And to you, Mr. Geoffrey. Very Merry Christmas, sir. Well, hard to believe it is Christmas with blue skies and sun scorching down. Doesn't seem right. I wonder if it's snowing at home.
Perhaps. Who knows? However, I think it's safe to assume that it'll be cold.
Oh, it'll be that all right, sir. There'll be a huge log fire burning in the servants' hall, a steaming bowl of rum punch. Oh, I can see it all.
A touch of nostalgia about it?
Beg pardon, sir?
I was wondering if you were feeling a little homesick.
Oh, me, sir? Oh, no, not homesick, not really. Well, maybe just a bit. It would be nice to see a familiar face, wouldn't it, sir?
Are you thinking of any particular familiar face, Barrett?
Well, sir, now you mention it, I do have a particular one in mind. Yeah, I do, I must admit.
Hazarding a wild guess, would the face be a female one?
It would, that, sir.
Mm-hmm. A young and pretty face?
Oh, she's pretty all right, sir. Pretty as a bunch of daisies, she is. You've seen her yourself, sir, many a time.
Have I?
Yes, sir. She's one of the maids at Blessington Hall. Gladys Smith. Old Bob Smith, the gardener's daughter. Been 2 years in service.
Oh, Smith's daughter, yes, yes. Yes, a very pretty child.
Oh, more than a child, sir. She's near on 17 now. I've been sort of waiting for her to grow up, you might say.
And you keep up a correspondence with her, do you?
Oh, I do my best. Though I must say I'm not much of a hand at writing letters.
Tuesday, 9th of June, 1908. Dear Tom, it's been a long time since I've had any word from you, though I suppose I can't complain because I'm not very quick at answering your letters when I get them. Though it's not because I don't want to answer, it's because I can never think what to write. Everything here is the same as usual. Nothing's really different since you went away. Oh, except, of course, there's a new underfootman, the fellow who took your place. Ted Sparks, his name is, and he's a right cheeky one. Oh, I read Dad that part in your last letter about Mr. Jeffrey hiring somebody to do his books for £7 a month and all found. Dad worked it out that, seeing as how you went to South Africa with Mr. Jeffrey, you'll be earning more than that, which means you'll be able to save quite a lot. Oh, leastways, that's what Dad said. What did you mean when you said that you went out shooting for the pot? Did you go as a beater for Mr. Jeffrey? I mean, you wouldn't be allowed to shoot alongside the gentleman, would you?
There he is, sir. Down there to the left, below the corner of Ritzer's Dam. I see him, Barry. Be ready, sir. He's going to flush those birds any second now. There they go, sir. Damn a blast. Quick, Barrett, fireman. A good shot. Well done, Barrett, well done.
Another one for the pot, sir.
Yes, and you're showing yourself to be quite a marksman, Barrett.
Oh, thank you, sir. Must say I've been surprising myself, never mind you, sir. Never handled a gun in my life before we come to Africa.
Natural eye, obviously. A damn good instinct for timing. It's not easy to down a bird on the wing. And you've accounted for 7 today to my brace.
Oh, good fortune, more than good management.
Don't be so modest, man. You're a damn good shot, and that's all there is to it. Here, Prince. Good boy.
That's it.
Drop. Good boy, Prince.
Hey. Yeah, it's a nice club one, this.
Oh, look, see where you hit it. Hmm? Minimal damage to the flesh. Capital shot, Barrett. Are you sure you never handled a gun at home?
Friday, 12th of March, 1909. My dear Geoffrey, it is now over 2 years since you set out for South Africa. At times, it seems that you left only yesterday. From your letters, I am conscious of a change in you. You told me that the ash tree slips, which you took from the grounds of Blessington Hall and planted on your farm, have taken root and are flourishing. Does this apply to you also? I feel that it does. What I saw originally as an adventure for you, a transitory experience, is fast becoming your life. Nowadays, your news is concerned solely with your business affairs, with the farm. You take pride in the erection of your new sheep dip, in your jackal-proof fencing, in all the improvements you are making and intend to make. And most revealing of all, when you tell me that you are importing tamarisk trees, the romantic and exotic aspect of such a venture quite escapes you. Your purpose is practical, and your satisfaction is that they will dispel salinity due to dam leakage. Do not misunderstand me, my son. I'm always eager to hear of your daily doings. I would merely point out to you that you are no longer a stranger in a strange land. You are putting down roots. You are becoming one with your surroundings. Is this what you wish, Geoffrey? But enough of my sermonizing. I was most disturbed to hear of the terrible drought you're undergoing, and what bad luck to send all your stock to the Orange River Colony only to find the same conditions there. One takes the abundance of water so much for granted that it's difficult to envisage being in dire need of it, and even more difficult for my mind to encompass the idea of month after month passing without any rainfall whatsoever. How does one conjure up rain?
Never rains, but it pours, as the old saying goes. Oh, it ain't half coming down, Mr. Jeffrey.
You're right. It isn't half. It's a whole lot.
Well, we certainly need it. Knew the weather was going to break, I did. I could see there were real rain clouds building up. And not just the empties coming back from Cape Town. This is just what the doctor ordered.
Yes, but I hope the cure isn't worse than the disease, Barrett.
Beg pardon, sir?
This rain. There's too much of it.
Too fast.
If it keeps on for any length of time, we could find ourselves with a serious problem on our hands.
Oh, you mean the crops, sir?
Well, they have already taken a beating. No, I was thinking of Beckett's Dam. The other should hold up, but we can't rely on that one.
I should be able to cope with this lot, sir.
You think so? I don't share your confidence, Barrett. I think we'd better round up some of the labourers and get down there. The dam will never hold. The walls will never stand up to this downpour.
Be wiser to get clear of here, sir. If that wall breaks, it could be nasty for us.
I've certainly no intention of standing back and watching a burst dam wreak its havoc on the land.
But what you going to do, sir?
Shore up the wall. Sandbags, that's what we need. Barrett,
I want every able-bodied person filling sandbags. Everyone, you understand? Let the rain do its worst. We are going to save the dam.
Tuesday, 31st of May, 1910. My dearest mother, the above date is an historic one and marks the union of South Africa. A new era is beginning, both in this country and in England, with the end of one reign and the commencement of another. One is conscious of regret that Edward occupied the throne for such a short time. He waited so long for his crown. However, the king is dead. Long live the king. And may George V steer a straight course to peace and prosperity for all of us. Certainly I shall have no cause for complaint if life goes on as it does at present. Everything is running smoothly, and my new farm manager, a towering giant of a Dutchman called Willem Potgieter, is a splendid fellow. I recently had a very pleasant respite from the toils of Sevenoaks when I journeyed to the port of East London. The purpose of my visit was, in fact, business, but it developed into something of a social occasion, due to my making several very interesting acquaintances, among whom was a Miss Catherine Spence. Miss Spence is a descendant of the 1820 settlers on both sides of her family, and has a fund of stories to relate concerning the dangers and hardships which faced the settlers on their arrival here. Oh, not from her personal knowledge, naturally. The stories have been handed down. They are quite fascinating, as indeed is Miss Spence.
So, you go back to your farm tomorrow?
Yes, in the morning. I wish I could stay longer.
Then you've enjoyed your visit to East London?
Very much. I particularly enjoyed meeting certain people.
You mean your hosts? Yes, the Dugmores are such a nice family, so entertaining.
Well, the Dugmores are very hospitable, but I wasn't thinking of them.
Weren't you?
You're not being very helpful, Catherine. In fact, you're being decidedly unhelpful.
Am I?
Well, you know you are. And you know what I'm trying to say.
I thought you were saying goodbye.
If you keep twirling your locket, you'll break the chain. It looks very old. Is it family heirloom?
Yes. It's very precious to me. It's from my mother's side of the family. The only thing left. Everything else was destroyed in the border wars. They lost everything.
Except the locket. Is it connected with the escape of your relative who swam the Kai River?
Oh, no. That's a different story altogether. You're mixing them up. It was my father's eldest brother who swam the Kai, Uncle Walter.
Well, there you are. You see how confused I am. That's because I haven't been told the stories often enough. You'll have to start from the beginning so that I can get the details set in my mind.
But you're leaving tomorrow.
Oh, true. But if there were sufficient incentive, I could return. And very soon.
And you'd really find my family history sufficient incentive?
I've always been fond of history.
Then if you come back, I'll arrange a meeting with Great Uncle Harry. He's the person you must talk to. He knows all the
Catherine.
Family. Yes?
I'm not interested in your Great Uncle Harry. I'm interested in you.
Oh, why didn't you say so in the first place?
10 o'clock, Monday, 12th of August, 1912. Dear Gladys, trust yours truly to be a few weeks late in answering your letter. I dare say you're used to that by now. I always mean to reply straight off, but you know how it is. Anyway, there's a lot going on here at the moment, what with one thing and another. They've started work on the new house. Mr. Jeffrey goes every day to see how the builders are getting on. Gonna be a real mansion it is. Something like Blessington Hall, only designed to suit the climate here. Mr. Jeffrey seems pleased with how it's going. To tell the truth, it's not the only house that's being built. There's another one going up as well. Oh, not on the same grand scale as Mr. Jeffrey's new mansion, mind you. I mean, this other house I'm talking about won't be having a morning room and a library and all the rest of it. But it's going to be proper nice all the same. And I think you'll be pleased with it. Drawing it out, aren't I? Do you get what I'm trying to tell you, Gladys? This is our house. Oh, excuse the smudge. My pen slipped when I was underlining the word our. Nice word, too. Just think of it, Gladys. Our own house. I don't know about you, but I reckon as how we've waited long enough. I hope your dad'll agree with me. Anyway, I'm going to write him a letter as soon as I finish this one. I'll have writer's cramp with all these letters. Never mind. Of course, your dad may object to the idea of your travelling all this way, thinking how much water there is between here and Merry England. But I don't see what else he can object to. I mean, I'm doing very well out here. Mr. Jeffrey's told me more than once he wouldn't know how he managed without me. Makes you feel good, that do. I love the life here on Seven Oaks. But I got different plans for the future. The distant future, I mean. I reckon you and me's gonna save our money, Gladys, and one day, when we've got enough together, we'll take over a nice little hotel somewhere. What do you think about that for an idea, Gladys? Mind you, as I've said, that's for the distant future. It isn't really important now. The important thing is you coming out here and the two of us getting married as soon as possible, if not sooner.
Come in.
You sent for me, my lady?
Yes, Gladys, I did. Come nearer, child. I can scarcely see you over there by the door.
Yes, my lady.
That's better. So, all set for your adventurous journey to Africa,
Yes, my lady.
My goodness me, what am I going to do if all my servants are drawn towards my son's African estate? Who will be left in Blessington Hall? Oh, don't look so alarmed, child. I'm not upbraiding you for going.
Thank you, my lady.
Although Mrs. Morton tells me that you'll be a loss. She says you're an industrious girl, neat and tidy. I'm pleased to hear it, Gladys. I think young Barrett should consider himself very fortunate. Not many young girls would dash off to marry a man in a country they've never seen. You're quite determined and settled in your mind, Gladys?
Yes, my lady. Truth to tell, I can't wait to get there.
Well, my son and your Barrett seem to have found the place to their liking. When do you leave?
5 days' time, my lady.
You've a long journey ahead of you, Gladys, with the prospect of a new and exciting life at the end of it. I sincerely hope that it fulfills all your expectations.
Thank you, my lady. I know I'm going to be happy.
With such obvious conviction, how could you be otherwise? And happiness is what I wish you, Gladys, you and Barrett.
Thank you, my lady.
I'm sure you know better than I what sort of wedding gift you would like, so this is for you, Gladys.
£10? Oh, no, my lady. £10. Oh, that's a lot of money. I couldn't take that, my lady.
You can and you will. You'll find a good use for it, I'm sure.
Oh, thank you, my lady. Thank you very much.
Wednesday, 21st of May, 1913. My dearest mother, on behalf of Catherine and myself, thank you for your blessing and for your thoroughly magnificent wedding gift. Our principal regret is that you will not be present at the ceremony next month. But we hope that circumstances will enable you to pay us a lengthy visit very soon. It would be a real joy to welcome you to our new home. I had a letter from Charles recently, and he wrote that he and Helen were in need of a long holiday and that he was seriously considering a voyage to South Africa, if he could find the time to get away from his constituency. So who can tell? Perhaps one day, Catherine and I will have the pleasure of entertaining Charles and his family. How easily those words flow, Catherine and I. Believe me, Mother, I'm a very lucky man to have found such a girl.
Friday, 16th of January, 1914. Dear Lady Blessington, how excited we were to receive your letter and know that you will be with us in September. And I claim my excitement to be even greater than Geoffrey's. At long last, I am to meet my mother-in-law. Our knowledge of each other has progressed through our correspondence, but what a poor substitute for a personal meeting. And now that meeting is to be realized. My one complaint is that September is such a long way off. And yet, why should I complain, when Geoffrey and I will have 8 months in which to savor the joy of anticipation? I must confess, however, that for me the joy will be tinged with a modicum of trepidation. How awful it would be if you didn't like me. On the other hand, I have 8 months in which to rid myself of all my unlikable traits. Oh, what a delightful year it's going to be. How could it be otherwise, when it commences with such good and welcome news?
Wednesday, 15th of July, 1914. My dearest mother, the most important letter I have ever penned. It gives me great pleasure to announce the arrival of your South African grandchildren. Twin boys, born this morning at 1 minute after 4 a.m. and 10 minutes to 5 a.m., respectively. Catherine is well, and both babies appear to be healthy specimens. Barrett and his wife Gladys have proved themselves to be towers of strength through this traditionally nerve-wracking experience, Gladys taking control of all matters appertaining to the nursery, while Barrett has lent me invaluable moral support. If the infants prove in any way prodigious, we shall endeavour to teach them to say, "Welcome, Grandmama," in time for your arrival in September. Or is this expecting too much of them? After all, they have 2 months in which to learn.
Wednesday, 5th of August, 1914. My dearest Geoffrey and Catherine, the dark shadow which has long been hovering over us has now descended. We are at war with Germany. While I have no doubt that our army and navy will win for us the victory, I am fearful of the prize which may be demanded of us. And I refer not only to the lives which will be sacrificed in the conflict, but to the sacrifice of our way of life. I've had many discussions on this subject with Charles and his colleagues, knowledgeable and intelligent men, and all are unanimous that a European war can only prove harmful to Western civilization. Germany and Austria will be defeated. Any other outcome is unthinkable. But neither England nor France will emerge all-powerful from the struggle. Who then will hold Russia in check? And what will be the effect of this altered balance of power? The prognosis of far-sighted men is not optimistic. But why am I boring you with my dreary contemplations? The declaration of war is depression enough without my adding to it. In truth, I have my own private depression, far removed from world events, though inadvertently caused by them. I fear my proposed visit to South Africa must now be postponed. My disappointment is beyond words. For so many months, I've been buoyed up with the thought of seeing you both and holding my darling grandsons in my arms. They are thriving, I trust. Kiss them for me and tell them that their grandmother sends her fondest love.
Saturday, the 20th of March, 1915. My dearest mother, after months of frustration and difficulty, my arrangements are at last completed. I have done everything possible to ensure that in my absence all will go smoothly on the farm. In the beginning, I hoped that Barrett, whom I trust implicitly, would remain here. But he is as determined as I am to answer the call of battle. So we both go to fight for king and country, to fight for the country of our choosing no less than the country of our birth. And it is the uniform of our adopted country which we shall wear. While Catherine is as sad as I am at the thought of our separation, she understands and accepts the necessity with all the fortitude and courage of her pioneering ancestors. Amongst the many things which I shall miss will be the first birthday of Charles and Geoffrey, Jr. God grant that by the time they are old enough to realize the significance of birthdays, I shall be back here to share them. They are both healthy and bright, and seem to grow by the day. When I look at them, safe and secure in this benevolent, tranquil country, in my mind's eye, I see other children, those in Europe, caught up in the web of war. There is only one way to give them back the peace and security which is their birthright, and that is to bring this conflict to a swift and victorious end.
Thursday, 9th of September, 1915. Dear Tom, I don't think I've ever said it before, but every time I sit down to write to you, I think the same thing. Here's me on the farm writing you a letter just like you used to write to me. And it wasn't so long ago either when you come to count it up. I remember when I was on the boat coming out to South Africa, I thought to myself, well, that's a days of writing letters to each other over and done with. I've never been very good at writing letters, as you know. Never know what to say, do I? So I was quite happy to think I wouldn't have to write, that we'd be together and it wouldn't be necessary. Anyway, I was wrong, and here I am chewing my pen just like I used to. But we never know what's in front of us, do we? Of course, before I came out here and we were married, it'll be 3 years on the 14th of December, by the way, in case you've forgotten, all I had to worry about was whether you'd meet someone else or maybe just go and forget all about me. And now it's different, and I've got something real to worry about, haven't I? And Lord knows I do worry about you, Tom, so do try and take care of yourself. Keep your head well down when there's any bullets flying about, and don't go trying to win any medals or taking on the Kaiser's army single-handed. I got my hands full being nursemaid to the twins and looking after our Susan at the same time. She's a real handful. Takes after her dad. Now she's walking, there's no keeping track of her. I never know what she's going to be up to next. If I take my eyes off her for a minute, she's sure to be in some mischief or other. And it won't be long before the twins have caught up with her. And what I'll do then, I don't know. As it is, I could do with 4 pairs of hands. Oh, talking of hands, that reminds me. I sent you off a parcel last week. Some woolen gloves and socks are knitted. I hope you get them all right.
Saturday, the 1st of January, 1916. My darling Catherine, I write on this first day of the new year. 1916. I wonder what it holds for us. Will it bring that which we all desire so passionately, an end to the fighting? I wish I were optimistic enough to believe so. But it is hard to keep optimism alive when the days merge one into the other in a continuing vista of carnage and desolation. I miss you very, very much. Here in a mud-filled trench, with the rain pouring down in a solid wall and the damp seeping into my very marrow, I dream of you, my darling. And we're together, walking over the veldt in the hard, bright sunshine. The present is so grey and dismal that one takes refuge in the past or in the future. Past and future, those are the two main topics of our conversations. The wonderful days we've known, and the wonderful days we'll know again.
Tuesday, 15th February, 1916. Dear Gladys, as you'd have guessed when you saw my scrawl in the envelope, yours truly is alive and kicking and still on my continental holiday, all expenses paid. Ha ha. I'll tell you one thing, though. I wish I had someone to carry the flaming luggage. I used to think a soldier was a fellow who went round swinging a rifle with one hand and saluting officers with the other. Well, I was right about saluting officers. I was wrong about the rest. The things we have to cart around with us. Honest, Gladys, you wouldn't believe it. I feel more like a pack horse than anything else. It's the truth. Mind you, I have got one or two bits of unauthorized equipment. A few souvenirs I picked up here and there. I thought it might be nice to have a few mementos to bring home to South Africa. I was tickled pink to hear how well our Susan's getting on. If she turns out half as pretty as her mum, she'd be a real corker. Can't wait to see you both. If they'd only hurry up and finish this ruddy war.
Sunday, 21st of May, 1916. Dear Lady Blessington, how good of you to write so frequently when you're so busy. I'm very envious of the work you're doing. Your whole way of living has obviously been disrupted by turning Blessington Hall into a rest home for wounded soldiers. Yet how wonderful to be able to do it. I know that my duty lies here, but I do so wish I could join you and play an active part. The little we are able to do seems so little. I keep having to remind myself that one must do the work which is closest to hand, and that even the most mundane tasks have their importance in the general scheme of things. Yet it does not assuage the guilt I feel. Here I am in the midst of beauty and peace, while so many are in the throes of deprivation and distress. I stand on the stoop of our house, and everything I can see, from Porter's Dam on the eastern horizon, to the row of tamarisks fringing the paddock, to the cluster of labourers' cottages white-walled and sun-bleached, to the merinos dotted untidily on the landscape away to the west below Beckett's Dam, everything, every single thing that I can see, every inch of the farm, reminds me of Geoffrey. How long before he comes back to me? How much longer will this war continue with its mindless death and destruction?
Thursday, the 13th of July, 1916. My dearest mother, I snatch a few minutes to write to you. Since the beginning of July, Allied troops have mounted a strong offensive in the Somme sector. By the time you receive this letter, the second phase of the action will have commenced, and our own South African brigade under General Lukin will participate. Morale is high, but there is an air of tension and expectancy as we await our final orders. There is no doubt that the fighting will be fierce, but up to the present, good fortune has marched by my side, and I trust will continue to do so. In recent weeks, it has occurred to me that I was born under a lucky star. Everything in life I could possibly desire, I have. When I think of Catherine and my sons and the farm waiting for me, the realization of what is mine fills me with wonderment.
England will ever be dear to me. But at this moment, I long for home, where my heart is. Thursday, 20th July, 1916. Etretat Hospital. Dear Lady Blessington, I don't quite know how to begin this letter, but I know I have to write it, because I was with Mr. Jeffrey at the end, and it's only right that you should hear firsthand what happened. I've already finished a note to young Mrs. Jeffrey. I can tell you, my lady, these are the two hardest letters I've ever had to write, so please excuse all the mistakes, but I can hardly see for the tears in my eyes. And that's the truth. We were at a place called Delville Wood. There was a lot of fighting, but I can't tell you any details about that, because when you're in the midst of it, there's so much noise and everything's so confused that you've got no idea what other people are doing, only what you're doing yourself, and not always even that. Anyway, there was a lot of shelling, and Fritz started a heavy counterattack. It seemed like men were falling like ninepins. And there was this young fellow, Carson, from Johannesburg, he was. I'd spoken to him a few times. Well, he was wounded, badly wounded, and he was cut off from us because the Germans had moved in and there were bullets flying all over the place. And Carson was trying to crawl back, but he couldn't manage it. I saw it all because I'd just copped a couple of stray ones myself. And all I could do was lie there. Anyway, next thing I saw was Mr. Jeffrey down flat on the ground and moving out to Carson. And I lay there, praying like I've never prayed before. Mr. Jeffrey got to Carson. Then he started dragging him back. And they nearly made it, Lady Blessington. That's the worst part of it. They nearly made it. They were only a couple of yards away when the bullets got them. Carson was killed outright. They brought Mr. Jeffrey and laid him down quite close to me. We had to wait there till they could get us to the dressing station. At first, Mr. Jeffrey seemed to be unconscious. Then, after a while, his eyelashes sort of flickered, and he looked at me. And he didn't seem surprised to see me. He just looked at me, quite ordinary-like. And he said, "Barrett, tell my mother, Catherine." And those were the last words he spoke.
Saturday, 5th of August, 1918. My dearest Catherine, my heart reaches out to you across the miles that separate us, and I cannot say, do not grieve, when grief is my constant companion. But I can say and do say, look to the future, for the future belongs to your sons, to Geoffrey's sons. In his very last letter to me, written only days before the fatal engagement, Geoffrey wrote, "When I think of Catherine and my sons and the farm waiting for me, the realization of what is mine fills me with wonderment." He also wrote, "England will ever be dear to me, but at this moment, I long for home where my heart is." My dear Catherine, those words of Geoffrey's are now poignant and tragic, but they bear in them all the shining promise of your country's future. He grew to love South Africa more than the land of his birth. It is your land, the land of your settler ancestors and the land of your sons. Theirs is a proud inheritance and dearly bought. As they grow to manhood, let them not forget the price which has been paid. Teach them to love their country as you do, as did their father, as did the long, unbroken line of courageous men and women in the past.
That was The Blessington Letters, a play for Settlers' Day by Annette Mackenzie and Jack Mulland. As Geoffrey Blessington, you heard Keith Grenville, and as Barrett, Glyn Day. Rosalie van der Goord was heard as Lady Blessington, and Petronilla Whitfield as Gladys. Catherine Spence was played by Judy Gibson. The Blessington Letters was produced by John Springer.
Listen again next week for another play from the archives of the Springbok Radio Preservation Society of South Africa in Radio Theatre.